right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep. We got a packed show today, so I'm just going to hurry up and introduce this. At the back end of the show, we'll be speaking with Carl Dix, who's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he is also all about these days. He is building very hard for Rise Up October. That's 3 days in October, the 22nd, 23rd, and especially the 24th of October, when thousands and thousands and thousands of people will be coming to New York City to take a stand, to draw a line sharp, saying, which side are you on, all right? Basically, making that choice and calling on everybody to make that choice, stand up against police brutality, police murder of black and brown people, the genocide that's going on. So stick around for that one. It's going to be a very good conversation. We're also going to be talking about, at that time, about the current, we're going to hit on a little bit, not spend a whole lot of time, but hit on a little bit, the recent police counteroffensive against all of those opposing police murder and terror in the country, and why we have to stand up against this, all right? But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to have this segment. I did this a little while ago at the time of the Pluto mission, the mission to Pluto in July, and NASA's New Horizons spacecraft sent the first close-up images of the dwarf planet Pluto, the largest body in a region of icy worlds known as the Kuiper Belt, beyond the inner planets where the Earth is and the outer planets. And we did an interview with planetary scientist Kathy Olkin, who's a project scientist with the New Horizons Project. And she's talking with us about how the spacecraft got to Pluto, the initial discoveries, and the drive to find out about the universe we live in. So without any further ado, check this out. All right. And I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Kathy Olkin, who is a New Horizons deputy project scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. And she's a planetary scientist with interests in the icy outer solar system worlds. And she's had a hell of a time this summer, probably one of the high points of her life, if not the high point. Kathy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. Well, me, along with everybody else in the world, I think, I hope, was like just mesmerized and stunned at what happened on July 14th this year with the exploration of Pluto. To be blunt, I hadn't really thought about it, didn't know that much about it, and was there even a reason to go there? But as we got into it, it just sort of ripped open my head and just made me as curious as hell and also amazed. And this was something that was as amazing as it was historic. And that was one of the things I wanted to talk to with you about first, is the press information from the project says that reaching this third zone of our solar system, which I guess is apparently what going to Pluto means, has been a scientific priority for years. Why is that?
It's been a scientific priority for well more than a decade to go to Pluto and see what it looks like as a stepping stone to the Kuiper Belt, which is the third zone of the solar system. When I was in school, I learned about the nine planets. There were the terrestrial planets and the gas giant planets, and then there was the misfit, Pluto. But around about 1992, more objects that shared the similar space as Pluto were being discovered, these Kuiper Belt objects. There's thousands of these icy worlds in the outer solar system, and we didn't even know about them just a couple of decades ago. So one of the main scientific priorities was to go to this region of the solar system and learn about all these bodies that are inhabiting our solar system that we didn't even know about before. And Pluto was the largest of these objects. It was discovered in 1930, and so we had known about it for a while. It was the best studied, and so what better place to start than by looking at Pluto?
Now, you know, one of the things, too, though, in relation to that, it's been a science priority for all the reasons that you've been saying, and there's also something that makes this, in and of itself, an historic event. I mean, I don't think it's something that anybody really thought about, you know, except you guys, you know, and others who are in the same function in the same world. But, you know, if you had asked me like 3 years ago, I would have said, I don't know what you're talking about going to Pluto. What's going on? In fact, Pluto had the ignominious pushdown of, no, you're not a planet anymore, buddy. Go over here. You know, you're a dwarf planet. This idea, the historic character of this mission, can we talk about that a little?
Yes, it's amazing to me. I mean, it is historic. One thing that I think is amazing, that Pluto was discovered not that long ago. And in some people's lifetimes, it was discovered and then explored. It was amazing at the encounter to have Clyde Tombaugh's children there. They're grown adults, you know, with their own even grandchildren now. But to have that close connection to the person who discovered Pluto is really quite astounding. And it really is a whole new world, a whole new area that we're exploring in our solar system, places we've never seen before, things we've never seen close up. And it's really been transformational in our understanding of the solar system and how the solar system formed, to realize that there's this reservoir of primordial objects out in the outer reaches of our solar system that are really kind of the remnants of solar system formation. And it seems to me quite clear that we needed to go there and see what it was all about.
Now, getting there, that's really intriguing in its own right, because everything seemed to have to be so finely tuned, worked and reworked before you could even think about embarking on this in order to get there. There was all kinds of questions came up, fuel, the energy, you know, the speed, everything. It was a fairly hairy endeavor to get there, wasn't it?
It was, and it was complicated even before the New Horizons project was funded. People had been trying to get a mission to go to Pluto since the late 1980s. And so there had been lots of false starts. The idea of sending like a small spacecraft really quickly with limited instrumentation, or how can we get there in a reasonable amount of time? It took 9.5 years for New Horizons to traverse the solar system from Earth out to Pluto. That's a really long time, and you need to make sure your computers are working, your cameras continue working. Everything needs to be in working order 9.5 years later. If you think about it, probably not that many people use a computer today that was built more than a decade ago.
What actually changed in the attitude towards getting there? The thing that would unleash you to be able to do that?
One of the big things was there was a decadal survey. So basically consensus in the astronomy community that really we had to go and see this third zone of the solar system. And that was really quite a tipping point for being able to get the project funded and moving forward. But along the way, there were many difficulties. One thing is the power supply for New Horizons is plutonium. And so that's not something that people have a lot of on hand. And, you know, the United States government had some, but it wasn't quite enough. And so we worked very hard to get the plutonium that we needed to make sure that we could launch safely. And all the other pieces had to come together to be able to make the mission work out. And as we were traveling, we launched in 2006. And it was after 2006 that more small moons of Pluto were discovered. When the project was first proposed, we knew about Pluto and its largest moon, Charon. And then in about 2005, about a year before launch, two more small moons were discovered using the Hubble Space Telescope. Those are called Nix and Hydra. And then as the spacecraft was traveling out towards Pluto, more deep surveys of the vicinity of Pluto were done. And lo and behold, there were two more moons. Those are now named Kerberos and Styx. And so even our understanding of Pluto and its environment was transforming during the years that we were building the spacecraft and traveling out to Pluto.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with planetary scientist Kathy Olkin, a project scientist with the New Horizons Project, the trip to Pluto. Kathy's talking with us about how the spacecraft got to Pluto, the initial discoveries, and the drive to find out about the universe we live in. The whys, the wheres, and the how comes. Now, one of the things you also came up against, which I thought was really, and I don't know if this was just my not knowing about it, but it was really ingenious, the point that you had to maintain a certain amount of speed to actually get past everything you had to get past in order to get even have a chance of getting to Pluto. And this whole idea of the big gravity assist from Jupiter, I was just blown away by that. One, that was even possible to do, to get that kind of assist, and how that made a critical difference in being able to carry the mission out.
That's right. Being able to fly past Jupiter was really important because it cut off more than 3 years of flight time for the spacecraft. Just like I was saying before, 9.5 years is a long time, and so you don't want to have to go more than 12 years in getting to Pluto, because then perhaps computers wouldn't be working or everything wouldn't be functioning quite as well. So it was really important to hit the opportunity of flying past Jupiter. And not only that, when we flew past Jupiter, not only did we get the gravity assist, but we had an outstanding opportunity to practice using all of our instruments in a real planetary flyby. And so that was another great thing that came from the Jupiter flyby. This idea of a gravity assist had been done previously with the Voyager spacecraft. And so that in and of itself wasn't new, But the critical nature of it was in that we were trying to get to our prime target, which was very far out in the outer solar system. The Voyager spacecraft flew past the giant planets and did gravity assists along the way, but they are also, their targets were those giant planets and their moons. So it was inherently different. When we launched, we had a pretty decent window of opportunity for launching the spacecraft, more than a month, but only the beginning part of that launch window would allow us to fly past Jupiter. So it was really fortunate that we got off early in our launch window so that we could have that flyby.
I saw that. That was pretty intense as I was reading. Now, you also, one more question on this, maybe two more questions on the sort of the things behind the scenes that were necessary to get done in order for this to happen. I also read in a number of spots about the hazards facing the mission, including something that was talking about just even a speck of dust no bigger than a grain of rice could have actually ruined the whole thing.
That's right. Yeah, we began to become concerned about the hazard and a potential hazard being in the Pluto environment when Pluto's small moons, Kerberos and Styx, were discovered. These small moons, along with Nix and Hydra, the other small moons of Pluto, when if something were to hit them, it would, just like on any body, make a crater and there would be ejecta or dust being ejected from the surface of the body, where the gravity would pull that dust back down to the surface. It could reach escape velocity and then be in orbit around Pluto in the Pluto system. So you could imagine that these small moons could be debris generators. They could generate small grains of dust or rock or ice that could be flying around in the Pluto system. And just something the size of a grain of rice could knock out, it could go through the spacecraft and take out critical functions. Because the spacecraft is flying at about 14 kilometers per second. And so it's hard to think in units like that, because when you drive a car, it's miles per hour, not kilometers per second. But one way to kind of think about it is, if you've ever done a 10-kilometer race, people do 10K races all the time, that would be being able to complete it in less than a second. So that gives you an idea how fast we are flying through the Pluto system. So because we were going so quickly, even small things were a real hazard. And these small moons could generate these hazards. So there was a huge effort put on by the project to go back and look at all the possible risks. What could be exposed on the spacecraft? How strong was the insulation that was covering the spacecraft? It's put there to help equilibrate the temperature of the spacecraft. But, you know, it also can be a little bit of a barrier. So how strong is that? Deep searches for more moons of Pluto so that we could know if there were potentially more objects that could generate debris. And so we had a number of campaigns on approach to Pluto where we were looking for really small moons. We would take long exposures and shift a little bit where we are looking and take another long exposure and look for anything down at the level of noise in the image that could be moving in orbit around Pluto. It was a huge effort, and in the end, we decided that it was safe to fly through the Pluto system, mm-hmm. which is really what we wanted, because that's what we had designed to get the most scientific return. And then, of course, now we've flown through the system and we know that it worked. So that all worked out well in the end. But there was a bit of concern. Yeah.
And one final question on the sort of preparatory aspect of it. I read somewhere a quote from you where you said that if you were talking about this and what you expected to see happen when you pass by Pluto, you were describing the unprecedented detail about Pluto that was collected. And you said that if we dropped New York City's Central Park onto Pluto, we would be able to see the ponds in the park. That's how unprecedented this view is. Clearly, this had to require some extraordinary equipment.
That's right. So we took really high-resolution imaging. We took imaging of the whole surface of the encounter hemisphere, the side that we flew by, at better than half a kilometer per pixel everywhere. But then we had selected regions that were much higher resolution. And we had some resolutions that were on the order of 50 yards. Each pixel would be about 50 yards on an image. And so we'll be able to get amazing detail in many of our images, and have gotten some of that data back, but none of the really highest resolution data has come back quite yet. And so it did take a really comprehensive suite of instruments that were designed to do this initial reconnaissance of the Pluto system. Mm-hmm. We had the LORI camera, which gives us our highest resolution data, and it's what will be giving us those images where you'd be able to count the ponds in Central Park if you could transport Central Park to Pluto. And it's like an 8-inch telescope inside of New Horizons, and the aperture looks out one part of the spacecraft. And then we have another instrument called RALF, and that instrument is really two instruments in one. It's a color camera and an infrared spectrometer, which really just means it's a way of mapping the composition of the ices on the surface. And so there was lots of thought put into how do we have to build the instruments to be able to get the data back that we wanted. The RALF instrument, the one that takes color images, the field of view of that color camera is almost 6 degrees, and that's how large Pluto would look from New Horizons' near closest approach. So it was designed so that Pluto would be filling the whole field of view near closest approach. And those are the sorts of details that went into designing the instruments to return the science that the mission needed.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with planetary scientist Kathy Olkin, a project scientist with the New Horizons Project, the trip to Pluto. Kathy's talking with us about how the spacecraft got to Pluto, the initial discoveries, and the drive to find out about the universe we live in. And just so folks know that this information coming back to the Earth is a process that apparently is going to take about 16 months, so we'll be looking forward to seeing more and more of that, hearing more and more about that.
Just one point on that. We had to be very patient to get to Pluto. And we have to continue to be patient because Pluto's very far away. And so it will take 16 months to get all the data down. But that's nothing like waiting the 9.5 years to get there.
Good point. And humanity waiting for so long for people to be able to think about going there. So that's a very good point. Carl Sagan said once that somewhere something incredible is waiting to be known. And I thought that was a good kind of capturing of the spirit of the whole New Horizons project. And I wanted to ask you to talk about some of the things that you thought were the most, just fantastic that you've learned so far about Pluto. And one of the things I was thinking about was just the surface of the planet. That just blew my mind how different it was from what people expected. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, the planet has just blown me away. The images are stunning, and the details that we've seen. I'd been thinking about what we'd see on Pluto for a couple of decades now, and I've just been blown away. The mountains that we're seeing is one thing that's interesting. I expected we might see some topography, some mountainous areas, but I thought maybe it would be like the rims of an ancient crater basin or something. And these mountains don't seem to be like that. So we're still trying to understand what caused the mountainous regions that we're seeing on Pluto. Another thing that's just been fascinating is this area that we informally call Sputnik Planum. It's in the heart shape that's on Pluto, which we informally call Tomba Regio. And so in Sputnik Planum, there's these polygonal, it's a flat plane of ices. And you can see these polygonal shapes with troughs defining the different polygons. And there's dark areas in some of these troughs. Some of it sticks up, and there's this pitted surface where you see details of, maybe sublimation with ices, the ices evaporating into the atmosphere. And then in other parts, it looks like there might be evidence of flow of these ices. You can see near the northern part of Tomba Regio where it looks like the ices have kind of flowed around some of these mountains or protrusions in the area. It's just amazing to me the diverse terrain that we're seeing and the different landforms, and just it's much more than I would have ever expected.
Now, apparently, one of the things that surprised me, and I think surprised a lot of people, is the fact that people often looked at Pluto as being sort of a dead rock. And that, in fact, from what you guys discovered, that there's apparently a lot of ongoing geological events, as you're talking about pointing to in some to some degree in what you've just said, but there's actually these ongoing geological events that are that apparently are showing that the planet is stunningly alive, as one person described it.
Yeah, really, the questions that it brings up of what is powering these flows of the ices across Sputnik Planum. We knew that there had been changes on Pluto. I've been studying Pluto for a long time, and we had seen that the atmospheric pressure on Pluto had changed between 1988 and 2002. And so we knew that there were some dynamics going on in the system, but the idea of moving ices is just amazing to me. So, yeah, this is an active world, and that really makes me and many of my colleagues have to scratch our heads and go back to the drawing boards and try and understand what is powering this? What is the source of heat that would potentially make these shapes that we're seeing on the surface? So it's an exciting time to be a planetary scientist.
Yeah, definitely. And also to be somebody just reading about it, because you guys are doing a hell of a job.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's talk about the atmosphere. That's another thing that sure. got a lot of people really surprised. The atmosphere on Pluto was very different than what they expected.
That's right. So the atmosphere is very different in a number of different ways, too. So one thing that was stunning was the image that we took soon after closest approach, where we looked back at Pluto, and you could see the hazes being lit up by the sunlight that was behind Pluto. It's really remarkable and beautiful to see that. First of all, that image was just beautiful. And then second of all, it's stunning because the hazes extend up to about 80 miles above Pluto's surface. And they have layers. You can see details of layers in the hazes when you look closely at the image. It's astounding to me that the hazes go up that high. And so we knew that Pluto's atmosphere was quite extended, but didn't expect to see hazes up that high. There had been ongoing debate about whether there were hazes in Pluto's atmosphere at all. And many of us who thought maybe there were hazes, or at least I thought maybe sometimes there was haze and other times there wasn't, because the ground-based data was kind of hard to understand what we were exactly seeing. But to see the haze extend that far up was just amazing to me. And then also, the New Horizons spacecraft gave the first ever measurement of the atmospheric pressure on Pluto at the surface. We have ground-based observations that you can do where you watch a star pass behind Pluto and you can get an estimate, a measure of the atmospheric pressure, but that's up at about 100 kilometers in altitude. But if you look right down at the surface, you can't measure that atmospheric pressure from Earth. So we needed New Horizons to do that. And the initial part of the data has been returned, and it looks like the pressure in the atmosphere is less than 10 microbars. A microbar is about a millionth the pressure of the atmosphere on Earth. Earth's atmosphere is primarily nitrogen, as is Pluto's, but it's a much thinner atmosphere. And so we saw that it was 10 microbars. The interesting thing there is that we expected it to be more based on some ground-based measurements that we had done before. And so that's a big mystery, too. What does this mean about the atmosphere? So a lot of us are digging into this data and trying to understand what's going on.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with planetary scientist Kathy Olkin, a project scientist with the New Horizons Project, the trip to Pluto. Kathy's talking with us about how the spacecraft got to Pluto, the initial discoveries, and the drive to find out about the universe we live in, the whys, the wheres, and the how comes. Now, one thing that you guys have all talked about is that as the New Horizons project went past Pluto, that it's going on and it's actually going to continue to open more doors, and doors that are going to be just as exciting as what was discovered with Pluto, including, is it the Kuiper Belt you were saying?
That's right. So Pluto shares its orbit, shares its environment with thousands of other objects, and we call them, all these objects, Kuiper Belt objects. And these bodies orbit out past Neptune. And the New Horizons spacecraft flew past Pluto. We didn't have enough propellant on board to stop and orbit around Pluto. We knew that when we designed it. We don't have the capability right now to launch a competent spacecraft, you know, with good instruments and be able to orbit Pluto. So we made the choice to fly by. And so we've flown by and we'll keep going right now. We've been searching for other targets out in the Kuiper Belt that we can look at. And our search team identified two potential targets. And we will write a proposal to NASA to ask to have what's called an extended mission. So our prime mission was to go to Pluto, and we've done that. Now we're getting the data back and analyzing it. But we're looking forward, and we would love to be able to fly past another Kuiper Belt object so that we could look at more diversity in this system. So we'll be writing a proposal to NASA, and with any luck, we'll get to we'll get an extended mission and be able to fly by another Kuiper Belt object and learn more about it. Now, one thing I will say is that this other object, both of our potential targets, are much smaller than Pluto, you know, more like one of Pluto's small moons, on the larger side of the small moons.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this about that, because one of the things that really struck me is that, you know, there's this whole point, and I think I've read it in a number of places, that people were saying that when you go into the Kuiper Belt and you're going into this place that's like the furthest outlying region away from the sun, it's, you know, all of this stuff that's, it's sort of once you get out of that belt, don't you go into interstellar space or something? And then there's a question that comes up where somebody posed that in going through the Kuiper Belt and investigating that, it poses the real opportunity, the chance to really discover things that were not even conceptually, you know, possible a little while ago, which was finding the basic ingredients from when the solar system was formed. That's a pretty heavy and amazing possibility, right?
Yeah, it is. So these Kuiper Belt objects, one of the reasons they're very interesting is because they're kind of like the building blocks of the planets. They're like the leftover remnants from solar system formation. You can think of the outer solar system of the Kuiper Belt as like for the solar system. So these are planetesimal small bodies that some of them would have accreted into the planets, you know, Mercury, Venus, out to Neptune. But many of them, those objects out far enough, are really the remnants of this solar system formation. And so that's part of the reason why we really want to go out there and explore to see what these bodies look like, what's left in this cold storage. So that's definitely one of our goals.
Mm-hmm. All right, my last question, and it's a long one. My last question is, it goes into the, basically it's around this thing of, you know, again, quoting Carl Sagan, where he talked about how we live in a world that's really dependent on science these days, more so than ever. But that the problem is that so few people in the world actually know about science. And it's both, in some cases, people are never given the chance to learn science. In other cases, it's people become very sort of cynical or I'm not interested in that, you know, whatever, you know, get very small-minded and stupid around it. But the thing of this mission, one of the things that I was really intrigued by was this whole way that the approach of that what we're doing here is not, you know, what's discovered here is the result of this New Horizons mission. It's not going to be people rewriting textbooks, but writing whole new textbooks, and that you really strove to put this before the people. And I thought, you know, going into it, not having any idea of what you might, you know, of, well, going into it, having some idea of what you might discover, but not having anything for sure, and not even being able to be absolutely positive that you would get all the way there without all the things we were talking about, the hazards and the problems that could, you know, could jump up and everything. But you guys seem to pursue things from a standpoint of something I think is very important, and that's from the basic human need to be amazed by what we live amongst, you know. And I thought that was and understanding how this all works. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that whole question of this thing just by itself, just the what this did already, beyond the historic character of the data that was found and deepening our understanding of the universe and whatnot, but the whole idea that human beings actually can now understand this kind, as far out as you guys have gone, as you've taken us, and the amazement that actually really adds a whole other dimension to human life, which I think is an important aspect of the way you folks really push this out and popularize this. Can you say a few words on that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So sharing the mission with the world was something that we on the mission team really wanted to do. everyone, we're so excited to be exploring Pluto, and we wanted to share that with everyone else, even not knowing what we would see or how it would go. This was exploration. This is exploration that we don't get to do much of anymore. You know, there was the time when, you know, Lewis and Clark would be exploring the West, or many other different phases of history where there was exploration going on. And this was exploration, I think, at its most profound, going on today. And it just was really important for us to share that with everyone. Everyone can be excited by learning new things and seeing what's going on with Pluto and what have we managed to accomplish. It was a little risky because we didn't know what we would see, and we didn't even know if the spacecraft would survive closest approach. We were optimistic. We had done all our homework. We really felt confident in our choice to fly through the system where we chose. But it was important that people could see this in real time, because that's the excitement. One day, no one knew there were mountains on Pluto, and the next day, they were out there and everyone could see, wow, look at those mountains on Pluto. Isn't that amazing? And the same goes for the glacial ice flows on Pluto, you know, these exotic ices, nitrogen ice and carbon monoxide ice. And imagine that, being on Pluto and seeing that happen. It's amazing. And I think there's something really immediate. And the great thing is that in this day and age, we can share that easily with the internet and the other ways to extend information, the media outlets. And I believe that we had a responsibility to do that so that we could excite the next generation, so that they can come up with whatever their New Horizons Pluto encounter equivalent will be when young kids who saw this get to grow up and say, I want to do something like that. And it may not be planetary science. It's just anything that excites and engages people and say, I'd like to learn more about this, that, or the other thing. It's really a responsibility that I think we all understood that we needed to be open and transparent about what we're learning, when we're learning it, and take the whole world.
And you've done a remarkably good job at that. So thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Okay. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Kathy Olkin. Kathy is a New Horizons Deputy Project Scientist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado. She's a planetary scientist with interest in the icy outer solar system worlds, and she was deeply involved with the recent New Horizons project going to Pluto and beyond. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with Carl Dix from the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the Revolutionary Communist Party, and we're going to be talking about Rise Up October, 3 days in October, October 22nd, 23rd, and the big day, October 24th. So stay tuned. Welcome back. That's What You Talking About from Janelle Monáe and her crew from Wonderland, right? Her Wonderland crew. And it's a really moving, very powerful piece. And it's being sung and performed all over the country. And it's something that people really need to take up and spread, because It's just that important, this whole campaign. And joining us to talk about this is Carl Dix, representative of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's talking with us about basically about Rise Up October, October 24th. And we'll check in a little bit about the other 2 days too, the 22nd and 23rd, about why it's happening, why it's necessary, why it has to happen. And we'll also be talking some about the counteroffensive that seems to have emerged very sharply over the last week or week and a half or so. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on again, Michael.
Sure. It's always a pleasure, man. And we always have such a good conversation, so I'm going to jump right into it, all right? For people that don't know, give them a brief synopsis. What is Rise Up October?
What Rise Up October is 3 days of powerful resistance to the horror of police getting away with murder in this country. October 22nd, 23rd, and 24th. October 22nd is the National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality, the 20th annual one, and it's going to be marked this year in demonstrations and other outpourings in cities across the country. Then things shift and focus on New York City. October 23rd is going to be a day of major nonviolent direct action focused on an institution of the criminal injustice system in this country and setting the stage and pointing things towards October 24th. October 24th is going to be a day of a national march to stop police terror. Which side are you on? Thousands upon thousands of people are going to descend on New York City from around the country. They're going to join with thousands upon thousands of people here in New York City, and through the sheer weight of our numbers, going to shut it down. And among the thousands upon thousands are going to be literally hundreds of family members of people who have been murdered by the cops, people who have suffered the devastation, but who have also become fighters against this injustice, not just the injustice that they personally suffered, but the wave of injustice that's part of a genocidal assault focusing on Black and Latino people in this country. So that's what Rise Up October is about, and what it is aimed to do is to just transform the way that people look at this, making very clear the depth of the horrors being committed on this front, but also making very clear that there's a sizable section of people in this country who are determined to act to stop these horrors.
Mm-hmm. Now, Carl, you recently spoke at a program that was a very powerful program. You, Cornel West, Reverend McCrory, and a number of family members. Very powerful program that people can actually access at revcom.us, and I would really advise people to do that. It's a mind bender. It really does open up things in a huge way. But you spoke there, and you talked about that in order to actually get a sense of what's the compulsion around why October 24th, why Rise Up October and why October 24th in particular has to happen. I thought it was really important that you actually step back and put this in, you contextualized it in the horror that America has been for oppressed people. Can we talk about that a little in terms of it contextualizing, being the context, the framework for the whole thing you're talking about?
Yeah, because look, I mean, in talking about the way that police get away with murder in this society, people have to both get the scope of that. And we are definitely not talking about isolated incidents. I mean, look, it's at about 800 people for just this year alone since January 1st to today, 800 people killed by police. The police admit that almost 300 of those people were unarmed. And then in the cases of all the other people, they often lie and claim that people who were unarmed were armed. This is what we're dealing with, but then we have to step back even farther and see that the killings that law enforcement is unleashed to inflict are a concentration point of an overall genocidal program embarked upon by a system that literally has no future for whole generations of Black and Latino people growing up in the inner cities across this country, a system that has stripped inner city neighborhoods of legitimate ways to survive and raise families, and whose program for dealing with that is one of criminalizing these generations of young people, treating them as guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence, warehousing them in prison, treating them as less than full human beings once they get out, to keep them going back and forth into prison. And it is literally a genocidal assault. That's what we're dealing with here. And we need to stand up and stop that. As I said at the program in Harlem last week, when you're up against the genocide, you do not ask the people presiding over that genocide to smooth out the rough edges or ease the intensity of that genocide. You rally people to stand up and stop it, and that's what Rise Up October is about, bringing forward those who are tired of suffering under this genocide, but also working to bring to their side many others who may not be directly suffering it themselves, but who refuse to stand by while the authorities are inflicting this kind of genocidal assault on other people just because of it, merely because of the color of their skins.
Let me ask you, we're going to come back to that in a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you again more about the bigger picture too, just a little bit more around that, because there is a point here of, you know, you, in your speech, you contextualize things by going deeply into what happened to Emmett Till in the 1950s. And then you talked about as well, then you went to Katrina and what happened to the black people in Katrina. And you could go, you know, you could actually look for things all across the board. I mean, I was just sitting there and I was just ticking off just these horrible atrocities that happened throughout history, the bombings of whole cities, of black neighborhoods and cities, the bombings of the Move House in Philadelphia, the filling up of the prisons, all this stuff. But there was something that you got into here that I thought was really very important in terms of, one, the overall thing about being straight up with people about, look, what the hell is it going to take to stop this? And I wanted to read this quote from Bob Avakian, because I think it's very moving, very inspirational, but also really true. And it has a lot to do with, I think, in terms of how you're looking at it, it seems to me, in terms of what I've read about you and what I know about you, you know, it's like it has a lot to do with how you're actually approaching things. So let me read this quote real quick, and then you can comment on this for a while, all right? And this is from Bob Avakian, all right? It says, "There is the potential for something of unprecedented beauty to arise out of unspeakable ugliness. Black people playing a crucial role in putting an end, at long last, to this system which has, for so long, not just exploited, but dehumanized, terrorized, and tormented them in a thousand ways. Putting an end to this is the only way it can be done, by fighting to emancipate humanity, to put an end to the long night in which human society has been divided into masters and slaves, and the masses of humanity have been lashed, beaten, raped, slaughtered, shackled, and shrouded in ignorance and misery." Let's talk about that, Carl.
Yeah, that's actually a very important thing that you did there. In fact, in my speech last week, I read that quote towards the beginning of it, because we not only need to bring out to people the horrors that they're up against and the need to stand up and fight them, but we also need to bring to people something that they really need to know, and that there is the possibility of pulling something quite different out of the jaws of that horror. And in fact, the only way that that can really be done is through revolution, and that there is leadership for that revolution that has developed a strategic approach and a plan and a vision for the future world that could be brought into being through revolution. And that leadership is the Revolutionary Communist Party and its leader, Bob Avakian. And it's coming from that perspective that drives me and us to be on the front lines fighting against these horrors, because we know that something better is possible. And we also see the way in which those horrors and people's response to them actually creates potential to bring that better, that beauty, potential beauty, out of this situation. And it also is what informs our approach of working to involve everybody possible in this, going very broadly among different kinds of people and working to bring together the kind of resistance that can stand up and say no more to this. So that was an important jumping off point or stepping off point in the talk that I gave. And it both gave people a sense of the depth of the horrors, but also opened up a vision of what could be won out of this. And of course, not everybody was united around that vision, but it really electrified the hundreds of people who were in the audience in terms of, yeah, we need to stand together, we need to fight this, and we can bring something different out of it. Things don't have to be this way. And as we fight, we say to people, as we fight back and resist against all this, let's discuss and debate what that future should look like, how it could be brought into being in ways similar to the what Bob Avakian and Cornel West modeled in the dialogue that they carried out last fall on revolution and religion.
Let me ask you this, Carl, because when you're talking about the, you know, within that framework and being open to all kinds of people who should come into this and take it up, there's also a point, though, that I think is important, no matter where you're coming from, if you're serious about fighting this police terror and murder, this idea that when you're fighting against a system that relies on this, you can't let the system suck you into framing what you're trying to do. You know, you're never going to be able to stop police murder, police murder and police terror if what you're doing is just operating within the parameters that they say is the okay thing to do. And it's interesting because I just got a note that an LAPD deputy chief would be interested in coming on my show and taking questions and speaking on the air, you know, to put out their side. And I'm sure to actually put out how to frame it. But of course, one of the things that he wants first is he wants to know what kinds of questions I would ask him. And the thing is, I kept thinking, you know, we're not going to get sucked into this framework, man. It's clear to people what you people are about. Now it's a question of actually people have to understand how do you frame this in terms of fighting it?
Yeah, because in fact, part of the reason that we have to do Rise Up October is because the system is trying to recapture the offensive and to suppress the resistance and take things back to the way they were before people begin to stand up in ways that we haven't seen in decades in the aftermath of the police murders of Michael Brown and Eric Garner and many others, and the exoneration of the cops who murdered Michael Brown and Eric Garner. And one leg of that has been trying to channel people's outrage at this down paths that aren't going to lead anywhere, and also demonizing the resistance. And you see both of these in effect right now. There's like a big wave of Black Lives Matter, the resistance that has grown up over the past year to police getting away with murder, is responsible for cops getting killed. And Black Lives Matter is a hate group that needs to be put out of business, according to Bill O'Reilly. And you got all of that going on. And you can see that what they're trying to do is to shift the terms of the conversation away from police getting away with murder to police being under siege, being targeted by these black protesters who are a hate group, and that people need to rally behind the brave cops who are doing a tough job heroically. And see, there is no heroism in gunning down unarmed, innocent people. And that's what cops do across this country hundreds of times every year. There's nothing heroic about that. And actually, if you dig underneath the hysteria that they're trying to kick up, it's actually the case that the number of cops who have been killed in the line of duty is lower this year than the previous year. You know, the killings have actually gone down. But you would never know that from listening to what they're talking about. And all this talk about, well, Black Lives Matter has sparked all this stuff off. Well, wait a minute. Black Lives Matter didn't exist last year. It exists this year. More cops were killed last year. How does this put together? But it's important for people to see behind that and understand the propaganda that goes along with that, as well as to see that when they talk about, well, the problem is really blacks killing other blacks, and the police have to be aggressive to deal with that crime and violence among black people, that's actually the system trying to get over on you twice, because the violence in the inner cities, the fact that large numbers of people are driven to illegitimate things and fighting amongst each other in hopes of trying to survive and prosper in that way actually needs to be laid at the feet of the system as well, because it's the system that has stripped away the legitimate ways for people to survive in its chase after profits. You know, moving the entry-level manufacturing jobs that previous generations of blacks and other oppressed people used to move into and work to survive, even though they were on the bottom tier of the workforce. Well, now those have been moved halfway around the world in search of workers who can be exploited even more viciously than they were exploiting people here. So they have put people in that situation. Then they try to use that situation to justify the way in which they are unleashing a genocide against the people in the inner cities. And this needs to be exposed and spoken to, and people need to actually understand that the way out of this is not the channels that they put out. It isn't appealing to them to do something about a situation that they've caused in the first place, but it's through fighting the power, fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution.
Let me ask you this, Carl. We have just under 5 minutes, and I have two questions. So this one in particular, I want to continue this a little bit more, because this whole point about what's been happening, particularly since the most recent killing of a cop in Houston, and the whole thing that has come out around that, where on Fox, on everywhere you look, there's all these people talking about and arguing that, for instance, that the silent majority must now step forward and stop, you know, step up against and speak out against this sort of the lies that are being told by all those people who are saying they're against police brutality, that there's this fight to repolarize things in a way when they're conjuring up the silent majority and they're saying that it's us against them and it's all this other stuff. There's a point here where they're really trying to, these sides are shaping up. And it has a lot to do, I think, with what you've talked about in terms of one of the things that October 24th is meant to accomplish is, in fact, to draw this dividing line even more sharply. And the polarization is beginning now, but we can't allow it to be a one-sided polarization.
Exactly. And that's part of why the theme of Rise Up October is Stop Police Terror, Which Side Are You On? Because too many people are on the sidelines, thinking that this is not something that should concern them. And no, it should concern everybody who's got an ounce of justice, but they should not be drawn into this on the side of the police who are supposedly under siege, because that is not the reality of what's going on. What's going on is that cops and other law enforcement agents are being unleashed to inflict terror, especially targeting black people, Latino people, and Native people, because it's actually the case that Native Americans are killed and brutalized by police at the highest rates of any group, nationality-wise, in the country. And no one should feel that they could stand aside when people are being brutalized and killed because of the color of their skin. So we want to draw this line very sharply. We want to bring forward family members of people murdered by the police, give them a platform to speak about what really happened, to humanize the victims of the police who get demonized when the police kill them, and to challenge people that you cannot be neutral or on the sidelines when this kind of terror is being inflicted. You have to join in. You have to stand up to say that this must stop.
Mm-hmm. Carl, in maybe 2 minutes, if you can answer this, it would be really great. A number of people have talked to me about, well, I really like the idea, but they also say, but don't you have to present some actual demands to them? Don't there have to be some reasonable demands out there? And this is something that, you know, I've been having, you know, going back and forth with people, arguing with them about it. But I wanted to hear, I thought you spoke to it really well, and you have about a minute and a half now, if you could do that.
Okay, look, we have some demands. Stop police terror. Stop killing people. You know, and along with that, dismantle the whole new Jim Crow of mass incarceration. Drop the charges against all the people arrested for protesting. Those are reasonable demands unless you operate a system that is dependent on this official violence to suppress and beat down people that you hate and fear, which is the actual backdrop and motivation for this official violence that this system unleashes. And for them to say, oh, you have to come up with the reforms that will ease the intensity of what we bring down on you. First off, the goal is not to ease the intensity. The goal is to stop it, and you have to stand up and demand that it stop and not come up with these increments, you know, because every increment that you can come up with, like body cameras on the police, which Obama suggested in November, right before the cops exonerated the cops who murdered Eric Garner, we had a video of Eric Garner being murdered. There's a video of John Crawford being murdered, and in both cases, the cops were exonerated. So don't give us these incremental steps, because any incremental step can be incorporated by the system and turned against you. And we have to say, no, stop this. It's got to stop, and bring forward demands that point to that, and not these incremental steps, which come down to changing the paint on the slave chains. Mm-hmm. No, we got to break the slave chains and end slavery.
All right, real quick, Carl, how can people find out more about this?
Yikes. Unfortunately, we seem to have lost our connection with Carl, so we're just going to move on and close the show out right now.
If you want to get involved, if you want to find out more about Rise Up October, you can go to stopmassincarceration.net. You can also go to revcom.us, all right? Very important to go there and find out all about it. And you can also get access to the whole meeting that was going on, which featured Carl, Dix, Cornell West, Reverend McCrory, a number of other people, a whole slate of people standing up and organizing to get this thing off the ground and moving in the way that it needs to be moving. And again, go to RevCom to keep up on all of this and so much more, all right?
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And finally, I want to thank all of my guests today. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at my new email address, which is mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you, so don't be shy. Write to me. We're going to go out now with Baby Huey's cover of Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come. Talk to you again next week.
I was born by the river. In a little tent. Oh, just like the river's been a-running, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change is gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause my mama never told me what goes on beyond.